Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
This section that I said I would sort of lead on, I'm going to downplay it here. When Mormons look at some of the wording and things that seem similar, so for instance, the famous quote, it's a serious thing to live in a society of possible gods and goddesses. To remember that the dullest, most uninteresting person you talk to may one day be a creature with, if you say it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship. Skip a little bit. There are no ordinary people. You have never talked to a mere mortal. Nations, cultures, arts, civilizations, these are mortal, and their life is ours as the life of a gnat. But it is immortals whom we joke with, work with, marry, snub, and exploit. So there's this idea of everybody's divine, and you know, and you see, but does that mean that he thinks that human beings can become gods and goddesses themselves? That's the distinction. One of you guys mentioned his notion of becoming little Christ versus big Christ. Who was it?
I said that, yeah.
Okay, and so let's just quickly make sure that there's a couple of distinctions here. Not that to me it only makes it slight. I think Mormons have the potential to do more with this particular idea than C.S. Lewis even imagined, but to me this the impact of his insight of the glory of the soul. For him, though, all souls were created by God. God is the only eternally existing being in the universe. Everything else is creatures. But there's this beautiful thing about C.S. Lewis in that every particular creature, even though we have different gifts and different things, I can't remember, is it somewhere in Mere Christianity he talks about each of us having a different kind of car to drive? Some of us have these really neat sports cars and others are jalopies or whatnot. He does have this real sense of God and salvation being a process, and that everybody is going through it, and for whatever reason God has created us at these different kinds of characteristics, but everybody's capable of really being bright and stuff. So when he talks gods and goddesses, he's talking that way. Mormons, on the other hand, you know, where we have this whole idea of there is no uncreated anything, that God is working with pre-existing beings that are capable of enlightenment, and you know, Joseph Smith, the whole idea from the King Follett discourse of God finding himself in the midst of spirits and glory, thought it wise to, you know, put together a world and kind of put some things out there to help others advance, you know, like the God thing. That's a whole different thing in the sense of we actually believe in Mormonism, or at least it's a reasonable position to take within the Mormon thought system, that we would actually could become gods and goddesses of other worlds, where C.S. Lewis would probably drop his start from there, because how could a created being ever, you know, become truly God? So does that seem like a fair distinction to make?
Yes.
I think so, but it's also, you find it enough in his work, this argument of this kind of theosis happening. You're like, okay, what are you arguing? Because it sounds really close. And again, he doesn't go strike quite as far as we do with the little Christ comment and whatnot. But
he couldn't. He took the sovereignty of God very, very seriously. And
exactly.
So, yeah, it's a paradox for his theology. Mormons just kind of like ignore the paradox and just like run right through the wall. Like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like,
but you wonder when he comes across the Christ statement, when Christ says, "Ye are gods," in the New Testament, is he drawing from that? What is he drawing from? Because it does come up again and again in his work, and not just the Weight of Glory essay, but just in Christianity and other places. It's just, and it's a consistent idea. And so I don't know exactly where he would place it.
Theosis isn't a wholly non, I mean, it's not, it's not a foreign concept to non-LDS Christians. There's a lot of theology that's been done around the concept of theosis, but the distinction, and a very important distinction that Dan was making, is that in Mormonism, we are humanity is ontologically the same as God, just at a different stage of development, you might say. But in Orthodox Christianity, God and humanity are ontologically different, and so whatever we reach, whatever a redeemed human being looks like, and however, you know, full of glory and majesty that person might be, it is nothing like the Trinity, nothing like God. Right. Ontologically.
Right, yeah. Yes. You couldn't join the Trinity and yeah. Yeah. So that's great. So yeah, and I really ought to put together a show on theosis and other traditions and sort of wrestle with that. So thank you for reminding that. But I do love the parts of C.S. Lewis where, you know, you kind of get these echoes of Martin Buber with the I thou, that because of this, this is how you treat other people. You know, that someday these are glory, these are people full of glory. You know, you get that sense of namaste, and, you know, I acknowledge the God or the light, the divinity that was in you. So I love all these attitudes, but again, if we're Mormonism is trying to say that C.S. Lewis was actually on the same plane with us, I think we have to say that there's at least a line there. But like you say, Mahan Rai, perhaps around the edges of his thought, he might have been grasping for something more, or sensing something more, but you know, his own thinking wouldn't have quite gone there, at least I wouldn't think.
Exactly.
Okay, then the other main one that I guess I wanted to take on was, and this again is in Mere Christianity, but it's in a lot of his other writings, and it's where he talks about the moral law. You know, it's like you'll never understand God by looking at the mountains and the beauties and stuff. Yeah, you can kind of get a sense that God likes beauty, but he says you'll get a lot more sense of God by looking at the moral law within you, this deep feeling. So he says, I'm not talking about particularities of this is right and that is wrong, but that something's right and something's wrong, and we all have these things. So he says, you know, you could never imagine a society in which rape would be thought to be good, or that you should be honored for running away in battle. He says, you know, there'd be no society like that. You might as well imagine that 2 and 2 equals 5, as to think that there wasn't something underlying these specifics that would say this is right, this is wrong. So his whole thing is the moral law is given by God, and that's how, that was actually one of his main arguments towards God, right? When he was getting through his mythology and his atheism phase, was this moral law that's within us. So again, where does the moral law come from within Mormonism? With C.S. Lewis, it comes purely from God. The whole idea there with Mormonism is there is no, God did not create morality. If we look seriously at Alma 42, if we look seriously at just this idea of everything's uncreated and that God just sort of got there ahead of us by aligning God's self with the things that would make for greater connectivity between individuals or whatever, those things that we end up calling morality or a deep sense of morality, we don't necessarily say that they are the invention or they originate in God. It would be more that God incarnates this pre-existing, whatever it is that ties us together as eternally existing beings. Does that make sense?
Section in Alma 42 where it talks about justice and if God was not adherent to justice, God would cease to be God. I'm butchering it, but...
No, yeah. No, the Alma 42, God would cease to be God if mercy were to rob justice. But again, I guess I just wanted to make the distinction that when you have God that creates everything, like C.S. Lewis comes from that starting point, then, of course, if you find the moral law, then that is a creation of God, where within Mormonism we have a more of a fundamental sense of whatever that's eternally existing in the universe, if you want to advance, it is by cooperating, it's by growing together, it's by being in relationship with him. And our sense would be that the moral law is more simply the law of beings who honor each other as ends in themselves.
Right. They want a certain quality of life too. It's not a person. It's not a being that decided on all the rules and laws. When you're looking at a universe that has eternal matter in it, you know, you just draw out the idea that matter is bound by certain rules and regulations or laws, and that God himself was one who harnessed those to rise to a position where he is, or, you know, or some Mormons that say that he always was in that position, but that yet, you know, he didn't initiate it all. He perfected it all, sort of a thing.
And there's this social element with Zion and with just charity in general, you know, where it's God's binding us together. He's sealing us together. Our Heavenly Father and our Heavenly Mother are trying to gather the family, you know, and that familial bond, and but that it is family. That, I mean, we are co-eternal that way.
I was going to ask a question. Do you think it's fair to say, you said earlier that in Mormonism nothing is uncreated, but do you think it's fair to say that maybe a distinction is that in Mormonism lots of things are uncreated, whereas in Orthodox Christianity, God is the only. So yeah. We're uncreated. The laws of the universe, right, or the laws of sociality, the laws of love, these sorts of things, they are self-existent. Matter is self-existent, and we simply function within this universe that is somehow.
Right.
Whereas for Lewis, everything proceeds from God.
Right, and that's why Lewis would make an argument like the Christ myth is the myth of all myths, and there was a design to that, and so when you see it in these other theologies, this is God's plan in these other societies to at least get them, you know, sort of revved up and ready to recognize when it's big, whereas Mormonism, you know, you don't need to make that argument at all to do it. Does that... Boy, I ran out... My last few sentence words were bad. But with Mormonism, you know, you're not drawn to have to say that. I mean, I know Nibley liked the idea of, you know, with Adam and Eve, you have the original religion and things like that, and there was sort of a diffusion model. But I don't think that that's necessarily true. It's just more like the fundamental nature of the universe would lead to humans feeling these particular things, having these energies come their way.
Sort of like the anthropic principle sounds like what you're describing, right?
They would just shape stories based upon these feelings. You know, it's like, what comes first? Does the story come before the experience? No, the experience comes before the story. The story is a reflection on it. And so that's why you would naturally just see these similarities. You would see water motifs as a cleansing thing, you know, as just a natural thing that would sort of arise out of experience, rather than having to say, oh, it's because they were having a flashback from the original thing when Adam was baptized. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think what you're describing is cool. I think that most Mormons would say that, you know, would probably use the original source, like from Adam, that's how they'd explain the existence of similar myths and
yeah, it depends
stuff
on
like
how
that.
Literalistically you read the Book of Moses, basically.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And so, yeah, like I said, I know Nibley did it, but it certainly doesn't feel to me that the metaphysics leads you to have to say that God was, that's God's directing, and that all these other things are just shadow forms of some original, brighter, fuller thing. I don't think we need to go that way. So anyway, let's cut this section close. I just wanted to make a couple of distinctions there, that when we do see some things there, and he makes these great arguments for the existence of God based upon the moral law, I'm not sure that, you know, Mormons should make that much hay with it, that without God, we would all be immoral beings. I think there's something about the self-existent nature of entities that when they're in relationship, things work or they don't work, and from that we call it the moral law, but it's based upon something that really isn't existing and articulated until individual beings articulate it.
Right. I think what you're basically expressing an anxiety with the possibility that a divine being could declare by fiat a morality, which means that there could have been a possible universe in which child abduction would be a moral thing, a good moral thing, you know, because that was declared by God, right? So it sounds like you're proposing the idea that there's something more fundamental than God's decision as far as what makes something moral, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that that's where our theology leads, and happy to take comments in the sections, and I'll even do a whole argument, some Mormon Matters episode on this. But here's what I really want to do, guys. I know that we have four of us here who all love C.S. Lewis, and there's pieces of him that have just like taken our breath away. They've shaped ourselves. They've made it into our lives as Latter-day Saints. And I just want to give us all a chance to share a couple of those each. So, Katie, if you don't mind, I've indicated to you that I'd love you to lead this section.
Sure. I think that for me personally, just on my own, you know, my own spiritual journey, I think the most profound lesson or concept that I've taken from C.S. Lewis is the idea that the starting point of the spiritual journey, the starting point of spiritual transformation comes with authenticity and truth. And by truth, I don't mean abstract truth claims, but facing the truth about oneself. And there are a couple of works of Lewis, especially Till We Have Faces and The Great Divorce, that really drove this home for me and got me thinking about it. First of all, when you think about The Great Divorce, so for those who haven't read it, I mentioned earlier that it's a, you know, the damned take a bus ride up to hell, from hell up to heaven, and what you discover when they come out is that the damned fundamentally are not real. They are ghosts. They're wasting away. They're disappearing. They're vanishing. They can't even step on the grass in heaven because the realness of the grass cuts their feet like glass. It's diamond hard for them, and it's excruciating. And it's this idea that realness, not necessarily righteousness, which had been sort of my paradigm growing up, but realness, not righteousness, is what distinguishes the saved from the damned in this world. Now, in the book, in The Great Divorce, as you take the first few agonizing steps through the grass and the water that tears up your feet and into the mountains or into the hills of heaven, as you go, you become more and more real. And who knows really what lies in the mountains beyond? That's the part of the spiritual journey that, you know, that maybe Lewis, it doesn't get into too much in that book, but that the starting point is reality. And coming to face, you know, what is actually true about oneself. And I think that's really driven home in Till We Have Faces, when Arul is having her epiphany. I'll just read this quote. She says, "I saw well why the gods do not speak to us openly nor let us answer. Why should they hear the babble that we think we mean? How can they meet us face to face until we have faces?" And Lewis later explained in a letter that what he meant by that is that a human being must be speaking with its own voice, not one of its borrowed voices, expressing its actual desires, not what it imagines it desires, being good or ill for itself, not with any mask. In order to stand in the presence of God, you must stand as you are in order to truly begin the spiritual transformation. So that concept of authenticity is one that has influenced me on an extremely profound level. So that's the first one. I don't know if others have thoughts or feedback or other insights they've gained along those lines.
Till We Have Faces, I mean, that whole idea of that authenticity being really spoke to me too, where becoming your true self, you know, we becoming letting God transform you, like that analogy in mere Christianity, where C.S. Lewis is talking about God not wanting just to make a new wing or fix a wall, but he's coming to live there, and so he's transforming the whole house. You know.
Yeah, that's on my list to share. Do you want to talk about that one right now? It does relate to what Katie's saying.
Go ahead, Dan. Go you speak to it.
I have the quote here. this analogy, and it fits hand in hand with a little bit about Eustace, where he was needing, when he's the dragon and Aslan has to do the job, you know, you can't do it yourself, but it's that God sees, you know, things that you'll go through about willing to transform yourself a little bit here or there and stuff, but you won't really do the work that needs to be done, which is actually to let yourself be killed or to totally surrender. And so this analogy of Lewis is, it's from Mere Christianity. He says, imagine yourself as a living house. God comes in to rebuild that house. At first, perhaps you can understand what he's doing. He's getting the drains right and stopping the leaks of the roof and so on. You knew that those jobs needed doing, so you're not surprised. So that's kind of the idea of, yeah, this is what I'm willing to do. You could probably get to those drains and roofs yourselves. But then he goes on. But presently he starts knocking the house about in a way that hurts abominably and does not seem to make sense. What on earth is he up to? The explanation is he is building quite a different house from the one that you thought of. Throwing out a new wing here, putting on an extra floor there, running up towers, making courtyards. You thought you were going to be made into a decent little cottage, but he is building a palace. He intends to come and live in it himself. So there's just that whole point of Lewis saying that the actual move is this becoming authentic, getting rid of all the masks and things like that is simply, truly, no more excuses. And like you say, the great divorce, you know, you've got a character there that, for instance, is having this old vaudevillian sort of, I think they call it the tragedian, you know, is speaking for this person and offering the complaints in that big melodramatic way. And slowly the ghost that's holding him on a leash is getting smaller and smaller and disappearing into the tragedy, the tale of woe and pity and things like that. And so all these masks, there's another character in The Great Divorce where a woman who had lost her son and just couldn't get over it. And she loved him so much and she wanted to possess him and she was willing to even have him come down into hell with her, you know, and C.S. Lewis finds, how is that love? You know, the George MacDonald character is telling a person, how is it love to be possessed? Everything just has to be becoming real, like you said, realness over righteousness, Katie.
Mm-hmm.
So, sorry, I rambled.
No, that's awesome. I think he's spot on with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
You get that with his conversion, you know. Again, like I was mentioning before, he takes that bus ride, and at that point he says he had to take off the armor, where he felt like he had to become really, really vulnerable towards God, and show his face finally, you know, because before that he was kind of a pompous ass, you know. He was rude. He was confrontational, and it was all an act. It was all a mask, and it was all just him hiding underneath the bush, you know, hoping that God didn't notice him.
And even later in his life with Joy, who, you know, became his wife, and so she's still calling him on that crap, at least according to the Shadowlands script.
She was great New York influence on him, you know, where no nonsense, you know, you don't put on that pretension with me. And again, that was the difference between The Problem of Pain, his book there, and The Grief Observed, is that he was feeling the grief on the second one, and the other one was an intellectual exercise.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, thank you, Katie. We'll come back to you for another piece or two. Blair, do you want to go next with anything that really has struck with you?
Yeah, the chief thing for me, and this is what became my capstone for my minor, was as reading through his letters and seeing all of his responses regarding this idea of the virtuous unbeliever. And he tells an account of the Inklings all sitting around late at night talking about the scriptures. And he says that they were trying to hash through some of these implications of some of the scriptures that bothered them. And on one occasion, there was discussion of what he called the most distressing text in the whole Bible. Narrow is the way, and few there be that find it. And that distressed him because he had a hard time believing in a universe where the majority would be damned,
right,
at the same time as believing in the goodness of God. And Charles Wren, who was one of the Inklings, took the view that it didn't matter whether that confirmed to your own ideas of goodness or not. And Charles Williams disagreed, and then they got in this really big fight, and he said, oh, now I understand why the Inquisitors felt it so right to burn people, you know, like over these arguments. So they're talking about ecumenism, and then they're talking about burning each other in sort of Inquisition. But that verse stuck with him and troubled him a lot. And you can tell in his letters that he thought about that a lot. And later on, there's another reference where he says – Dare we gloss that text, straight is the way, and few there be that find it, by adding, and that's why most of you have to be bustled and badgered into it like sheep, and the sheepdogs have to have really sharp teeth too. I hope so. So few there be that find it, and that's why God's got to drag us all in like he drug me in, is sort of what Lewis is saying, that he didn't find it. So that's kind of how he glossed that text, but he always had this preoccupation with what would happen to people who didn't find Christ, who died, but that were good people or from different religions or that had had bad experiences in Christianity. And he would just counsel people, look, I can't point you to a scripture on this that's explicit. I wondered about Christ descending into hell and preaching to the dead. I don't know what to make of that. That might be a possibility. But I see him really struggling to come up with ways to reconcile that. And one of the things, I think the main way that he does, and this is my concluding thought on it, he incorporated it into the Narnia books. In the last battle at the very end, here's a spoiler alert for you, so if you haven't read it and
it's
you want
to.
It's
the end of the world.
Yeah, so.
The world ends, everybody.
Yep. So one of the characters finds himself in the heavenly Narnia, standing before Aslan, who's the Christ figure, and he feels out of place and ashamed there because he felt like through his life he had worshipped a false god called Tash, was the name of this false god. So anyway, he feels like, you know, oh, here I am in front of this true god, and I, you know, anyway, here's the excerpt. The glorious one bent down his golden head and touched my forehead with his tongue and said, oh, it's a lion, by the way, that's why he's touching his forehead with his tongue, and said, son, thou art welcome. But I said, alas, Lord, I am no son of thine, but the servant of Tash. He answered, child, all the service thou hast done to Tash, I account as service done to me. Dost thou understand, child? I said, Lord, thou knowest how much I understand. But I said also, for the truth constrained me, yet I have been seeking Tash all my days. Beloved, said the glorious one, unless thy desire had been for me, thou shouldst not have sought so long and so truly, for all find what they truly seek. And I really like that idea that we can be seeking something, we can be seeking God without even having that title on the thing that we're seeking. Does that make sense? This idea that God can work with us when we explicitly know he is, but he can also be working with people who aren't aware that that's what's going on. And his openness to seeing the kingdom of heaven as an open and welcoming, almost universalistic place,
right,
is really appealing to me, and I think comports well with what Joseph Smith proposed. Obviously, he had a different way of doing it through ordinances and proxy work and whatnot, but the general idea is the same, that their desires mattered to God, and their actions in life mattered to God, and that God can work with everybody, even when people aren't exactly aware of that happening.
Yeah, there's an echo there too of the Tash business of, you know, the one true myth versus the other myths, in the sense that he's saying that, you know, you were going through these other myths, but it was really me that, you know, because you were seeking me, you were seeking the more. Oh, I'm not saying this right, but well, could you see, yeah, you see the,
yeah,
echo that I'm talking
one,
about?
Yeah,
there?
One,
yeah,
thing he said was like, you know, you're addressing your letters to this person, but you know, God just, you know, scribbles out the address and puts his own on there anyway. It gets to him. So like,
or I'm still stalking you, and that's why you think you're going, you know, to this lesser deity than me, or you know, this not complete thing, but it's still my action, and the fact that you were still seeking. That's your honoring of me. You're
yeah, you were
me.
Seeking
yeah.
the good. You were seeking right. the good. You had the wrong name on it. That's fine.
Right.
I love that. So thank you so much, Blair. Is there any more on that point you wanted to make?
No.
Awesome. Mahanrai, give us a favorite.
Horse and His Boy has been a favorite of mine for a very, very long time. There's this passage in here where Shasta... He's had a pretty tough little life, little Shasta, and he's in this dark canyon, kind of misty canyon, and he's riding this horse alone, and he's crying, and then this voice comes upon him. He wonders, is this a giant? Is this what? And but Aslan appears to him, and he tells him to tell him his sorrows, and so Shasta goes through the litany of all his various sorrows he's endured through the book, and says how unfortunate he is. And then he says, Aslan says, "I do not call you unfortunate," said the large voice. "Don't you think it was bad luck to meet so many lions?" said Shasta. "There was only one lion," said the voice. "What on earth do you mean? I've just told you that there were at least two the first night, and there was only one. But he was swift afoot. How do you know?" "I was the lion." And as Shasta gaped with open mouth and said nothing, the voice continued. "I was the lion who forced you to join with Erebus. I was the cat who comforted you among the houses of the dead. I was the lion who drove the jackals from you while you slept. I was a lion who gave the horses the new strength of fear for the last mile so that you should reach King Loon in time. And I was the lion you do not remember who pushed the boat in which you lay, a child near death. So they came to shore, where a man sat, wakeful at midnight, to receive you. Then it was you who wounded Erebus?" "It was I." "But what for?" "Child," said the voice, "I am telling you your story, not hers. I tell no one any story but his own." This idea that God knows our story, that with C.S. Lewis, he talks during his conversion, he talks about feeling this presence, and he learned to trust that presence. But at first he didn't trust it at all. He thought it was inflicting him, he thought it was hurting him, you know. But like Shasta, this idea of God being this personal God accompanying us on the journey, helping us through these troubles and these griefs and these pains, that really strikes me. And that Aslan is connected to every person's story on an individual level. And during the Chronicles of Narnia, he's talking to people on an individual level. And sometimes you don't even get to hear the conversation. C.S. Lewis says, "And that's not your story, so you don't get to hear it," you know. But that
right,
there's
this, I remember that.
Yeah, and that there's this personal relationship. That he's a personal God. He's not some kind of distant deistic God who abandoned us. But that our father and our mothers are right there. And of course, C.S. Lewis include the mother, but that God's there. Christ is there. And that was a really important idea to me. And that whenever there's been times where I've just wept at that passage. And I'm kind of a romantic, you know, if you couldn't tell. C.S. Lewis is, as much as his intellectual rigor and his strong arguments, it's the soulful part of him, this yearning he talks about. And there's something about him connecting so much with childhood that really gets me, because I had a really imaginative and soulful and a happy childhood. And when I became a grown up, it seemed to go to pieces, you know. Mm-hmm. And I've been reading the Chronicles of Narnia to my son, and I read them to my nephew David when he was a boy. And to see them have these deep theological questions, to have them this yearning kind of spring up to them, this joy which they can't describe at such a young age. It's what it did, because I encountered Lewis first when I was a child, reading the Chronicles of Narnia, and to me that's... It harkens back to that moment in the wardrobe with him and Warnie, where they're just telling each other the stories, and there's something magic in that wardrobe with those stories.
It's beautiful, thank you. Any comments on Mahanrei there, you guys?
I wouldn't try to add to that, no.
Yeah, that was lovely.
Beautiful. Katie, give us another one.
Okay, this is a lot less lovely.
Okay.
But I think that Mormons specifically could stand to learn a little bit from C.S. Lewis in terms of theology of sexuality. And I think Lewis does a good job of taking sexuality seriously. I don't know that he wrestled too much with homosexuality or anything like that. I recall in Surprise by Joy, he actually said because he hadn't been tempted that way, he really didn't even address it. So he had a non-condemning position, I think. And I could be wrong about that. But Mormons have built up the idea of sexual sin being the sin next to murder, the worst thing you can do besides, you know, killing your grandmother. And Lewis, I think, had a much healthier perspective about that. So one quote that I like from Mere Christianity is when he says, "The sins of the flesh are bad, but they are the least bad of all sins. All the worst pleasures are purely spiritual, the pleasures of power and hatred. For there are two things inside me competing with the human self which I must try to become. They are the animal self and the diabolical self. The diabolical self is the worst of the two. That is why a cold, self-righteous prig who goes regularly to church may be far nearer to hell than a prostitute. But, of course, it's better to be neither." I think that's very wise. And the other thing that stuck out to me in The Great Divorce is that none of the damned ghosts that we meet are saved except for one. And the one who is saved is the one who is tormented by lust. He's the one that's saved because his vice is more human. His vice is rooted in something good, as opposed to what Lewis calls the diabolical self that's rooted in the desire for power and hatred. And the McDonald character says after the ghost tormented by lust is redeemed. Dan, you alluded to this. What happens is the angel. So lust is sitting like a lizard on this ghost's shoulder, and the angel approaches him and says, "You know, can I kill it?" And the guy says, "No, yes, no, yes, okay, do." And the angel wrenches the lizard off his shoulder and destroys it, and then the lizard becomes transformed into a great stallion. And the man rides off on the back of the stallion into the hills of heaven.
And the ghost takes on flesh and becomes bright and beautiful.
He becomes real. Right. He becomes solid. Right. He's redeemed. And the McDonald character says about that transformation, he says, "What is a lizard compared to a stallion? Lust is a poor, weak, whimpering, whispering thing compared with that richness and energy of desire which will arise when lust has been killed." So here Lewis isn't, you know, at no point in his work do you get the sense that he condones lust, that he, you know, says, "Hey, kids, sleep around," you know, nothing like that. But there is a healthy attitude, I think a much healthier attitude in Lewis's work about sexuality than tends to be in many corners of Mormon culture, especially speaking as a woman, you know, who grew up with the many licked cupcakes examples and the Twinkies smeared all over the face, you know, object lessons where, you know, that were shockingly bad. There's a sense that the sexual energy or the power that we have within us, it is something that is rich and energetic and of God, and that giving into that is it's not a great thing, but it's sure a heck of a lot better than giving into the coldness of power and hatred and the diabolical vices, the desire to control, the desire to own. You know, all the people that go to hell in the Great Divorce, you know, they're all the ones that want to possess others and lord over them and be right at all costs and stuff like that.
Or just not be in relationship with others. One of my favorite things about hell, you know, they're at this little bus station when they gather, but all the streets are abandoned around it. And what it is in hell is as soon as you get mad at your neighbor, instead of trying to work it out with them, you just go build a house on another street. And so he just talks about how hell is just spread out because nobody wants to be in relationship with each other.
Yep.
Just to add real quick on the – just since you mentioned the homosexuality issue, Lewis was kind of he was definitely a conservative in terms of sort of politics and other issues. As far as homosexuality goes, he just didn't think it was anybody's business. He felt like it was sinful, but that it was someone's sort of personal vocation. If a Christian was a homosexual, they should seek to overcome that or to at least live a celibate life. But he also didn't think anybody should – that it was anybody's business. His best friend Arthur Greaves was. It's been said that he struggled with homosexual feelings, or that he was a homosexual. He definitely had some compassion for that. So he kind of felt attacked by people who were much more stringent on that issue, and also by homosexuals who were much more activist than he wanted to be as well. So, I mean, but, and by conservative, I mean also he was sort of like on women's ordination and stuff. He was not in favor of, and so you know he had different sort of views on a lot of that stuff. And that's peripheral to the point you were making, which I think was made very well. But since you brought it up, I thought it might be interesting.
Right. Also, yeah, and I wanted to make the distinction with that point that when I spoke about sexuality, I was speaking about not necessarily sexual orientation or
just
gender
just
roles,
general sexual feelings in general,
yes,
right? Sexual
exactly.
fulfillment, right?
Yes, exactly.
The idea of bridling your passions, right? The Book of Mormon. It's interesting. The Book of Mormon has that image of bridling your passions, right?
Right.
Not extinguishing them.
Right, and certainly not if you might as well have. You know, murdered somebody or whatever.
Right. You should have murdered somebody, or you might as well have, you know.
Right.
Speaking in that vein about, C.S. Lewis also seemed to be a lot less afraid of man-to-man love, not necessarily sexual love, but just, I mean, like
totally.
In the Four Loves, you get this beautiful idea of being this beautiful chapter on friendship. And with him, his best friends were all these men, and they were just talking about literature, and there was this lot of this affection and love and warm feeling towards one another. And in today's modern culture, we don't get that kind of almost Greek sense of comradeship. I mean, women often do, but men, we're afraid to touch each other. We're afraid to get personal. We're afraid to – and C.S. Lewis wasn't like that. He had these really strong male-to-male friendships and male-to-male love. In a way which is sometimes foreign to modern people, I think.
Hmm. Terrific. Blair, do you want to go to another favorite part of Lewis for you that's had an impact in your life?
Oh, I mean, I just think that just that general idea that I think Lewis is – that we shouldn't just stop with Lewis. We shouldn't just appropriate him in terms of what we already think, but sort of like – was already suggested, this idea that we can find things that Lewis might have to teach us that differ from things that we've believed thus far, or that we can find interest in other theologians in general, that Lewis himself can merely be a gateway into more theological thinking, because he certainly played that role for me. So I would encourage people that are familiar with his work to continue in that vein. There's so many things to think about, so many questions to have, and he was definitely one who was willing to ask questions and talk about things, and willing to be uncertain about some things. He felt certain about what he viewed as most important things, but he also countenanced quite a bit of uncertainty in his faith, and I think that can be a healthy way to be a disciple. Is a disciple in spite of uncertainties.
Thank you. Mahanra, do you want to do another one?
Yeah, with me, the myth becomes fact, the true myth idea, like I kind of mentioned before, that's huge in my thinking right now, and that's just huge in how I see the world. Almost this, I have this Jungian Joseph Campbell kind of idea in my head of this reoccurring myth, this pre-existent memory that's just kind of rattling around in us, and that comes out in the form of stories. I mean, and as a dramatist and as a playwright, I'm always attracted to the story element of life, you know. And there's this great quote in his essay, Myth Became Fact, and he's addressing his atheist friend who pretty much makes that argument to him, kind of like we touched on before, that I mean, this is all mythology. C.S. Lewis is having his old argument reversed on him, basically. And he responds with this: "Now as myth transcends thought, incarnation transcends myth. The heart of Christianity is a myth which is also a fact. The old myth of the dying God, without ceasing to be a myth, comes down from the heaven of legend and imagination to the earth of history. It happens at a particular date, in a particular place, followed by definable historical consequences. We pass from a Balder or an Osiris, dying nobody knows when or where, to a historical person crucified under Pontius Pilate. By becoming fact, it does not cease to be myth. That is the miracle. I suspect that men have sometimes derived more spiritual sustenance from myths they did not believe than from the religion they professed. To be truly Christian, we must both assent to the historical fact and also receive the myth, fact though it has become, with the same imaginative embrace which we accord to all myths. The one is hardly more necessary than the other. The man who disbelieves the Christian story as fact, but continually fed on it as myth, would perhaps be more spiritually alive than the one who assented and did not think much about it. And that's in God in the Dark, in the essay, Myth Became Fact. And I love that idea of the true myth. I love that idea that imagination is a holy thing. I've once read an essay in the Deseret News. I mean, I think it was Chris Cannon who was writing it, I'm not sure. But as kind of, or Joe Cannon, one of the Cannons. And he was kind of going on a tirade against imagination, that the scriptures call it vain imaginations. And to me, that it just really struck a negative chord. I'm like, oh, don't you dare. No, you didn't. Because to me, my imagination has been very vivid since I was a child again. And, oh, sorry, I'm getting a little emotional now. And it's what's made me be able to conceive God in some fashion and not just be so tied down by my own limited rationality, my own limited logic, and be able to see beyond myself. And with Lewis, he helped me, Jack helped me so much with that, where expanding whole worlds and creating spirituality. And even the Narnia stories, they're myths. They're not true, but that doesn't make them not true, you know? And so as a playwright and as a storyteller, that's vital to me, that idea of telling true stories, whether they're historical or whether they're imaginative, but telling true stories. And sometimes they're both. Sometimes they're imaginative and true. They're myth and fact.
That's great. Yeah, no, he does nail that, right what you just said. That's all over his work. So that's wonderful. Thank you. Katie, did you have any more?
There's maybe one more that I would, you know, that I'd want to close with. And that is, you know, C.S. Lewis talks a lot about the nature of love and what is love, what is real love, what is redeeming love. And again, going back to the Great Divorce, when the tragedian, as you were talking about earlier, Dan, meets his wife. The tragedian's been in hell.
Well, the dwarf, the ghost, and the tragedian,
right,
is sort of like the ghost's complaint. It's,
yes,
like he lets it speak. It's his mask for speaking,
yes,
what he wants. He's afraid to say.
Yes, thank you. So the ghost's been in hell, and he's got this mask, or this, you know, the tragedian that speaks for him. They encounter his wife, who's been redeemed, and the exchange goes like this. And I think it's brilliant. But so I'll just read it. "You mean," said the tragedian, "you mean you did not truly love me in the old days?" "Only in a poor sort of way," she answered. "I have asked you to forgive me. There was a little real love in it, but what we called love down there was mostly the craving to be loved. In the main, I loved you for my own sake, because I needed you. And now," said the tragedian with a hackneyed gesture of despair, "now you need me no more?" "But of course not," said the lady, and her smile made me wonder how the phantoms could refrain from crying out with joy. "What needs could I have," she said, "now that I have all? I am full now, not empty. I am in love himself, not lonely, strong, not weak, and you shall be the same. Come and see. We shall have no need for one another now. We can begin to love truly."
Right.
And I think that's profound, and I think that that's kind of the secret, of the secret to life, perhaps, right there. So
awesome. And that just reminded me, I published in Sunstone, I think it was my second or third issue, a wonderful piece by Mary Beth Raines, which was the link between spirituality and sexuality. And the way she demonstrated the different stages was a lot of times through poetry and song lyrics. And there was that whole, the earlier stages where I want you, I need you, I can't live without you, oh baby, please come back, you know, kind of stuff. And then the higher stages are illustrated by this beautiful, we delight in each other because of the, you know, the love of
Christ. That, you know, I mean, there was some piece that were explicitly Christ language, but it was this complete, like she says, there is no need. There's no craving for each other because we're in wholeness, but yet that has made our love this completely, you know, bright and shiny thing. Yeah, because we don't need each other anymore to be complete.
Right. And that's all for love's kind of talk, which C.S. Lewis, in that book, he says some very similar things right there.
Yeah.
Awesome. I'll link to that article. I'll remind myself to do that because readers, you got to read the Sunset article. It's fantastic. So thank you. Thank you, Katie. Either of you other guys, I've got one just to close with, but I don't want to give you guys, if there was something you definitely wanted to share, please do.
That's pretty much it for me. I would say my dialogue article on Lewis and Mormonism should be available through academia.edu.
It's in the free section of Dialogues.
Oh, right on.
Website too. It was like the second newest one that was ready. So I'll link to that too, Blair. So thank you.
Cool.
With me, I think it's again, I touched on this before, is the pain thing, where having an intellectual concept of pain and that God's using pain to help us. It's God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world, you know, and that he had this very intellectual approach to pain. But when he met Joy, his wife, and she died of cancer. And again, cancer runs through his life. His mother dies of cancer. His father dies of cancer. Joy dies of cancer. I think maybe Charles Williams died of cancer. I can't remember, but it was cancer just spreads through his life. And he knew, but when he was young, he shut himself off from it a bit. After the death of his mother, he went into those intellectual regions and didn't explore down there very often, you know. But that with Joy, he really not only opened himself up to pain, but to love. And again, if anybody has not seen Shadowlands or read it, beautiful, beautiful story, beautifully done. Anthony Hopkins makes a great C.S. Lewis, favorite actor. And as a dramatist, I really appreciate it on that level too. But just this idea that it's something, life is something we experience, and we can't just have this, and we see that in The Grief Observed, where his life becomes suddenly really poignant and personal. That life is personal, and we need to get into that personal grid of it. And that's where God is. And just like with Shasta and Aslan, you know, God was sometimes in the claw marks. So I think that's it for me.
Wonderful. Thank you. Well, you know, everyone who's listened to this show for a lot, and even in just when I shared in the little section there, I am so huge into Mormonism because of this uncreated nature of all things, and that, you know, that therefore there's just this freedom that I feel as an uncreated being, and as I plug that in as at the beginning of my thought and says, here I am, that there shouldn't be anything that God can do. I should never blame God because I'm always at choice, you know. So here's a circumstance here, and within Mormonism, there's this idea that, you know, somehow I chose that, or that there's nothing. I don't know. I'm not a victim. I'm always an agent, and I get what I want. So when you get into section 88, and you start looking at the different degrees, it talks there about those who are willing to do celestial law, you know, have a celestial body. You know, that's you know, whatever it is, your beingness is sort of in relationship with others at this completely open way that God would be, and that's a celestial thing. If you're willing only to do the terrestrial or the telestial, that's what you get. You're always at choice. And so there's this great line in C.S. Lewis's The Great Divorce, where somewhere in the middle of the book, it basically says there's only two kinds of people. You know, there's the people that say to God, thy will be done, or the people who God says back to them, thy will be done. In other words, it's up to us. That for us to transform, we have to sort of let God do the drawing. He's got to be the lion that claws off the skin. That, you know, we're willing to take it off so much, but we've got to be willing to submit to the true deep tear. That's just the part of Lewis that just hits me hard. It's the battle of my life. You know, there's these times where I'm feeling like, oh, yeah, I want this, but I'm still afraid to, you know, to truly surrender. And I think that that's where we're all at. We're afraid, like, oh, if I let my intellect lax for a minute and to allow other types of things to come in, somehow I'm at risk of losing my intellect, you know, or losing that being thought a fool or whatever it would be, all these different angles. And yet the second that you do it, the second that you say, okay, I'm willing to jump into the abyss or to lay myself bare and let the spiritual wash over me and not just the thinking part of me, you realize that, guess what? The intellect's enhanced rather than, you know, sacrifice. But it has to be that willingness to give it over to God, to put it on the altar, that is this complete, this thing for me. So Lewis, to me, even though he doesn't come from the same starting position that we as Latter-day Saints do with the uncreated nature of things, and even if he wants to, you know, put God as the reason that there's a moral law to begin with, I reject that theology. I feel like I'm from a different, stronger starting point with the Mormon stuff. But I'll tell you, nobody in the history of the world or anything I've ever read has hit me as hard as C.S. Lewis does when it comes to that particular, you know, piece of what the journey is about, and that is giving it over, giving it up, and trusting that somehow there's an enhancement that simply unfolds in you that was so far beyond what you ever thought. And that's come true in my life, and yet still I hesitate every damn day. So it's just the journey. But yep. But thank you to C.S. Lewis for, you know, being alive in my brain and in my mind and knowing that that is the move that I've got to make over and over again. So that's where I would end with my Lewis connection.
Beautiful.
Cool.
Well, guys, unless you have something else, know that I'm going to put all your good links up that I can to the various projects that you have related to Lewis, and I thank you very much for being part of this, and I hope you will come to the blog and engage with people as they ask questions, and feel free to pose your own comments on the blog, too, so I hope you will.
Sounds fantastic.
Listeners, thank you for the support that you give to Mormon Matters. I hope you'll keep it up. One of those weird little things in my life was this sort of call to, you know, not have a regular traditional job. And so one of the little pieces here that that what you do with your support for me is just vital and affirming to me that this is something good that might be happening. So thank you for that. So,
support Dan, send him money. I do.
Yes, you do. And so many of you do. And thank you. I'm not in the poorhouse, but it's always an interesting, you know, it's interesting to make the ends meet. So thank you for this piece of it. I do have other sources, but it's a jigsaw puzzle for sure. So thank you for that. And unless anybody with any final thoughts?
Nope, I'm good.
Okay. No, thanks for having us on.
Appreciate it.
Oh, it's been fun. So thank you. I wish you guys good night. And we'll just say here at the end, as always, cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.